Welcome to the Maria Heller Show, the internet's original podcast. Since the year 2000, always ahead of the curve, always on your side. A true warrior for truth and justice, Maria and her guests leave nothing out, and no one is off limits. There is only one truth, the rest is lies. Sit back, enjoy the education with a true daughter of Mother Earth. Sharp New York wit, spiritual knowing, and a very dry sense of humor, Maria will dissect the news and lies to make it all palatable. Education is power. Maria delivers rapid-fire truth like no one else can. Here she is, the mouth that roars, the legendary Maria Heller.
Good morning, world. Maria here, alive and kicking. Welcome to the show. Today I have absolutely one of my favorite heroes on the planet. He may not think of himself as a hero, but he's been one of my personal heroes since he was a teenager. His name is Nathan Runkle. He's the founder and president of Mercy for Animals. And Nathan's written a great book about his mission, I'll call it, Mercy for Animals, One Man's Quest to Inspire Compassion and Improve the Lives of Farm Animals. So good morning, Nathan.
Good morning. It's great to chat with you.
Yeah, it's been a while. It's been a while.
It has been a while. I remember our first interview together probably over 10 years ago, maybe even 15 years ago.
Well, I would say so. And I'm glad you're still doing what you're doing. And I could never believe I'm still doing what I'm doing. But here we are. Actually, I have one of my young students over the house and I showed him your book. He's a beautiful young man. He's 18 years old and he's also gay. And when I showed him your book and I told him your story, he was so impressed. So I said, you know, this is the kind of work that you can be doing too. Because young people today are really looking for to do something that actually has some meaning and where they can belong.
Yeah. Well, you know, the book has started so many conversations and I've been contacted by so many people of all different ages and backgrounds who have found inspiration and hope in the book. And that's really the reason that I wrote it. I wanted to share my story of going from a would-be fifth-generation farmer to founding an international animal rights organization and let people know that there is a path forward to live your values and make this world a kinder place. So if even a few people walk away feeling empowered and that their voice matters and that they can find a unique way of expressing that, then that really fills my heart.
Absolutely. And don't you call the work you do being a voice for the voiceless?
Absolutely. I mean, if you think about animals, most people, when they think about animals, think about dogs and cats or maybe pandas or elephants. But the truth is that when we talk about animals, we're really talking about farmed animals in our society. They are really the ghosts in our industrial machine. They are the 99%. Just in the United States, over 300 are killed every single second for food, most of them chickens. And these animals have personalities and minds and interests and families just like dogs and cats, yet few people will ever get to meet a chicken or a cow or a pig and really see how incredible these individuals are, how much their lives matter, and how we should do everything we can to protect them from harm. So they're not only invisible oftentimes, but they are voiceless and they are choiceless. And that's why I have chosen to dedicate myself to advocating on behalf of these animals, and it has been challenging, but the most rewarding work that I could ever imagine.
Right, and it's been physically challenging for you too, because I remember one of our very first interviews. I think you had spoken at one of these pig festivals or whatever, and you ended up getting jumped, and thrown out. So it takes a lot
That's
of
right.
courage to do what you do.
Yeah, I tell a lot of stories in the books about my early days as an animal advocate, everything from going into factory farms at night, risking arrest to document the conditions of hens used in egg production. These are really some of the most abused animals on the face of the planet. Most of them are kept in cages the size of file cabinet drawers where they can't even spread their wings. It is just absolute misery day in and day out. But at a young age, when I learned about factory farming, I knew I needed to do something about it. And going in and seeing it firsthand just really instilled in me how urgent this issue is, how real it is, how these individual animals are suffering so terribly. So we would not only document the conditions, but we would rescue animals as well. So that was sort of my first foray into risking arrest to speak up on behalf of animals. But the other incident that you mentioned is another example. It's at the Ohio Pork Congress, where we used to hold candlelight vigils outside, really mourning the nearly 100 million pigs who are raised and killed for food every year in the United States. And pigs are more intelligent than dogs. They're incredible animals, so social, so sweet, so loyal. But I tell the story of a disruption that we did to hopefully capture just a few moments of the mainstream media's attention so that people would think about the story behind their pork. But, you know, this was before the day of social media, before Facebook and YouTube. And we would go to almost any length to get people to stop for just a moment, perhaps to think about how their actions and their choices impact animals. You know, at the time, we didn't really care what people thought of us. We just cared if they would think about animals. And now, of course, with social media, we're able to reach hundreds of millions of people every year with undercover video footage. And I think that is part of what's really sparking this societal shift and change that we're seeing, with more and more people moving towards a plant-based diet. You know, the sales of veggie burgers and soy milk, rice milk, almond milk skyrocketing is because there is more transparency and there is more of a free flow of information. And I think the more that people learn about industrial animal agriculture, the less comfortable they become with it.
Absolutely. You know, it's interesting to talk about Facebook. I'm in my second ban of the week on Facebook. I've been banned every 2 days in a row. As soon as they lifted the ban, they banned me again. So if anybody's looking for me on Facebook, good luck with that. But what's interesting is I compose the most important news stories, horrific things going on in the world. Everybody will look at that. Everybody will comment. But when I put one of your videos on my pages, everybody says they don't even want to look at it. Okay. And I kind of figure it's some sort of disconnect, because once they look at what they're eating and the treatment of what they're eating, then it might ruin their dinner for them.
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of willful ignorance. I think that we're getting to a point where more and more people understand that there's something wrong with our industrial food system, and that there's something wrong with the way in which we raise these 9 billion animals every single year, how these animals are really reduced to production units and pre-processed goods, and they're not treated as individuals with feelings, both physical and emotional needs. But I think that this is part of a cultural evolution that's taking place. And I think you're absolutely right. Once people see how these animals are locked in cages where they can't turn around, how chickens have their beaks burned off without any painkillers, how cows have their tails cut off, how piglets are castrated without any pain relief. When people see that, when they hear these animals screaming and see the look of fear in their eyes, it's not something that any compassionate person can ignore. It's not something that you can unsee. So I think that a lot of people would prefer to go about their lives with blinders on to these issues. But as we know, society does not progress on any issues if we simply ignore the unpleasant and the inconvenient truths about what's happening. And that's true for our treatment of animals and other people in our environment. There has to become a time when we listen, when we observe, and when we do some reflection about if we truly want to support these industries that are causing so much harm, when we live in a day and an era where we don't need to. And in fact, it is becoming so easy to live a healthy lifestyle, and in many cases, a much healthier lifestyle by not eating animal products.
Absolutely. It reminds me, and I know you are familiar with Dr. Neil Bernard. He put up a video about a week or two ago saying that all cancer and heart attacks comes from eating meat. And when I posted that, you should see how angry people got and how defensive they got. And I was like, oh my God, if you could tell them that the president's about to go to nuclear war and they don't get as upset as if you attack their diet.
Yeah. Well, you know, food choices are viewed as being very personal, and they are deeply rooted in culture and tradition. Most people have a turkey, a dead turkey in the center of their plate for Thanksgiving. They associate the 4th of July celebrations with burgers. This is something that is so deeply tied for many people to their upbringing and their culture and experiences. And people love the taste of meat, dairy, and eggs. And I certainly didn't become a vegan because I didn't enjoy eating animal products. I gave these products up out of a desire to protect animals and in our environment and my health. But the truth is that we don't have to sacrifice flavor and enjoyment and culture and connection with other people in order to help animals. There are so many fantastic alternatives on the market now to literally every meat, dairy, and egg product. They have vegan foie gras. There's vegan caviar. There's vegan eggs. And these products are free of cholesterol. They have a much smaller footprint on the environment because animal products are so resource intensive. You know, the United Nations says that animal agriculture is responsible for more greenhouse gas emissions than the entire transportation sector combined. You know, when we eat lower on the food chain, we help not only animals, but we help our environment and we help our own health. You know, there's a great documentary that has been getting a lot of attention recently called What the Health.
Oh, yeah, I saw that. It was great.
On Netflix.
Yeah, I thought it was great. I said, oh my God, this has even got more new information than I already know.
Yeah, and I think that knowledge is power, and it's a cliche saying, but it really is true. And I think that so many of us go through our lives sort of with blinders on, not challenging what we are taught or what is projected to us by advertisement and industry. You know, most people go through life living the sad, eating the sad diet, the standard American diet, which is leading to heart disease, certain types of cancer, obesity, et cetera, not to mention 9 billion beautiful, sensitive creatures being brutally slaughtered every year. But there is a discussion that is growing louder and louder now. And it's one that's really long overdue.
I totally, totally agree. You know, what's interesting is, you know, I talked to some of my friends, my peers, one of them who's got diabetes and just got put on insulin, and he's a meat eater. And I said, well, didn't your doctor give you a diet to follow? He said, no. So you have people who have these active diseases who think a pill or an insulin shot gives them permission to just keep on destroying their bodies, but with the same, as you called it, sad American diet.
We really live in a country where we don't give enough focus or weight to prevention. We believe that there is a pill to fix everything. And the truth is that our bodies are incredible at healing themselves. Oftentimes, it's a matter of creating a healthy environment for our bodies to do so. And as the saying is, we are what we eat. And, you know, I certainly don't want to be sad and depressed and violent, which is exactly what meat is, not to mention, you know, dirty and destroying our environment. So much can be addressed just by the foods that we eat when we sit down every single day.
Right. Well, I'm no argument out of me, and I agree with you. You know, there's so many vegan products on the market now. You know, when I started 18 years ago, there was very little. So it was even more difficult to change your eating pattern. But today, I mean, you can even find vegan yogurt, okay? And it's like, wow, look at all these new inventions. And, you know, as an Italian, I have to tell you, there's a company, the name, I don't remember the name right now, but they put out Italian sausage that tastes just like the real thing, and it's all vegan. So whatever those taste buds are that people have, you know, you can eat that same taste without any of the bad effects on your body or on the animal kingdom. But I don't remember, Nathan, who was it that said that the only people that truly stay or stick with becoming a vegetarian or a vegan are animal lovers?
Well, you know, there's been a lot of studies done, and certainly people who are motivated by kindness, who this is an ethical decision, tend to stick with this lifestyle, not a diet, but a lifestyle, much more than those that are motivated by health. But I think it's also important to understand that this isn't about an exclusive club. This isn't a matter of all or nothing. And I think sometimes in our society, we are motivated for things to be all or nothing, black or white, good or bad, in every single way, shape, and form. And while I believe that a vegan diet is the most compassionate choice that we have, I think people shouldn't be intimidated to start down that path, you know, leaning in towards a plant-based diet, reducing their consumption of meat, dairy, and eggs. There's a huge movement towards Meatless Monday and being a reducitarian. And these are all incredibly important steps. This is incredible progress. If everyone in our country went meatless just one day a week, we would spare over 1 billion animals from the horrors of factory farms and slaughterhouses. So I think that, you know, as a culture, we need to look at the role and the place that meat, dairy, and eggs has had in our diet. And I think that most people, if they're being honest, can easily recognize that the consumption is way overboard, even if they're not comfortable getting on board with a completely vegan diet.
Right.
So I just want people to, you know, understand that it's not an all or nothing thing. And
absolutely,
that perfect shouldn't be the enemy of progress.
Well, it's interesting you say that. We can go back to Facebook. You know, I had joined several vegan, vegetarian Facebook pages. And then I started looking them over and looking at people's comments. And there was so much criticism and almost violent reactions to people who weren't 100% vegan. And I was looking at that and saying, what? This is supposed to be people coming from love and, you know, good health. To put those kinds of demands and put down, you know, vegans putting down vegetarians, vegetarians putting down octo-vegetarians. And I, you know, when people ask me, I always tell them, listen, nobody's perfect. We all can only do the best that we can do. But it was so ugly in there. I have to tell you, I unjoined from those groups because they were crazy. And I could see that would be a big turnoff to anybody who's asking something simple, like, how do I get started?
Absolutely. I think that many vegans can forget that at one point, most likely, they weren't born vegan or vegetarian, that this has been a journey for them as well. And I understand where the anger and the frustration and the sadness comes from. Mm-hmm. When you see what happens to animals in these situations, it is clear that this is an urgent matter. But I think it's important, as you said, to remember that we come to a place of wanting to take action for animals from love and compassion and empathy. And I think that it is important to remember that love and compassion and empathy should be, and I believe must be, extended to everyone. Mm-hmm. And this can be a real challenge in life.
Right.
When you believe that someone is doing something wrong, to act from a place of love versus hate, versus anger, versus fear, because it is a natural tendency for us to do that, to project shame onto those who are behaving in ways that we believe are harmful. I understand the pull to do that. But I think that it takes real courage and wisdom to find that place of love again, to communicate with those who you believe are engaging in harmful behavior. And at the end of the day, we really need not to win arguments and fights about veganism. We need to win hearts and minds. And in order to do that, I think we need to show that we are joyful vegans, that we need to lead by example. We need to have open hearts and open minds if that's what we also want people to have for animals.
Right, right. Well, you know, I was reading your book and it's excellent. Okay. I will tell you, it was engaging. I didn't want to put it down. And I thought I knew so much about you because I've interviewed you since you were a teenager. But when you just start out the book saying you were delivered by a veterinarian, I said, now, I don't remember ever talking about that with him. That's kind of cool, considering what you ended up doing with your life, that you'd be brought into the world by a veterinarian.
Yeah, it is. It is a bit poetic, I guess you could say. You know, my dad, for those who haven't read the book, which I would assume would be the majority of people listening, my father, Mark, was a veterinarian. He graduated from OSU in Columbus, and he then started the horseback riding camp, which is where he met my mother, Joyce. So, in some ways, I guess you could say that my fate was a bit sealed. I had two parents who met because of animals, who both had a deep interest and big heart for animals. And animals were always front and center for me. My earliest childhood memories are with our dogs and cats, who I very much considered to be members of our family.
And your little pet rat. Let's not leave out your little pet rat.
Yeah, so it was our dogs and cats that really taught me that animals had the same desires for freedom, the same, you know, interest in life, the same curiosity as we do. But like most people, I really only saw that lens for dogs and cats. And growing up on a farm, I saw many people draw this arbitrary line between which animals we cared about and which animals should be protected and all other animals,
right,
including farmed animals and others. But it was a little rat who I named Caesar that really started this evolution for me in terms of being consistent about how we view animals. The story of Caesar is really just one of coincidence. Across the street from our house, across the cornfields, the backcountry road, a couple named Gene and Sylvia raised animals for experimentation and research laboratories. They raised rabbits and mice and rats and guinea pigs. And they rented the property from my parents, and they had a huge red barn and then some smaller sheds. And one afternoon, I went over to Gene and Sylvia's house with my mom to collect the rent check. And Sylvia knew of my deep love and fascination for animals, and she asked if I wanted to see the rabbits and the rats and the mice. And I, of course, said that I did. And now I really look back in horror on what was happening there. These animals just crowded into cages, the smell of ammonia burning your nose, just filth everywhere. But she reached into one of these cages and pulled this little rat out by his tail and lowered him into my hands. And he was so beautiful. He's a Siamese rat, so had similar markings to a Siamese cat, just this smoky gray around his eyes and his tail. And I begged Sylvia to allow me to take him home with me. I also begged and asked my mom. They both agreed. I later found out that the going rate for one of these rats was $1. That was the price that was put on their lives to be sold to experiments, or they'd be drowned, shocked, electrocuted, poisoned. And I named him Caesar, and he really became my best friend. I was about 6 at the time, and he would sit on my shoulder. He knew his name. He would come running. He was so intelligent, so clever. And he started to teach me that it wasn't just dogs and cats that had these personalities, that right. whose lives should be given consideration. And I would bring friends and friends' parents over to the house to see Caesar. I'd take them up to the room, and most of them would shriek in absolute horror and disgust. They'd say, "Ooh, a rat, look at his tail." And I realized in those moments that these friends of mine didn't judge Caesar for who he was, the individual, right. but instead for what he was, a rat, and the baggage and the perceptions that we bring to the table with them. So it challenged my notion. It started to challenge my notion of why we call some animals pets and others pests, and some friends and others food. So I think, owe a debt of gratitude to just this little rat who was valued at $1 for starting to widen my circle of compassion and consideration beyond just dogs and cats to include
right.
those that society oftentimes pushes aside.
Well, that reminds me of that book by Melanie Joy. I think I still have that interview here on the archives, mm-hmm. why we look at dogs and cats as pets and why we're okay eating pigs. I forget the exact title of the book. But I'm sure you notice on social media, as soon as they post, the Chinese markets for dogs
right.
and how the dogs are, caged and then skinned and then eaten, how totally distraught everybody gets. And I'll always post, what's the difference between eating a dog or eating a cow? I says, it's all flesh.
And that's absolutely true. Americans are outraged when they see people eating dogs and cats. And we should be outraged, but we should also be outraged about the slaughter of pigs, who again are more intelligent than dogs. But intelligence shouldn't be our barometer for who we care about. It should be about whether they can suffer, whether they're conscious. And we know
right.
that, of course, that is true across the board for all animals.
There
is certainly...
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
there's certainly a hypocrisy here.
Oh yeah.
About which animals we care about and which we don't. And in many ways, the Asian countries that do consume dogs and cats are far more consistent with their view of animals.
Mm-hmm.
It's most Americans who are inconsistent.
Right. Well, you see the same thing with horses, when they exposed, remember if it was Burger King in Europe using horse meat or what, and
right.
people got right. so incensed over it. And I'm like, what's the difference? And then I had a story a few months ago of some human flesh that was found in some foods. And people were up in arms, and my answer was the same. What's the difference? It's meat, isn't it? You know? But maybe those are why I get banned. I don't know. But so let me ask you this, because I don't remember. How old were you when you started Mercy for Animals? How old were you?
I was 15.
And what prompted you to do that? Because I'm sure, and I know that Mercy for Animals has certainly grown since you started with basically yourself and maybe a couple of friends.
Yeah, well, today Mercy for Animals has 130 employees in 6 countries, millions of supporters. So it is the largest organization dedicated to advocating on behalf of farmed animals. So I'm incredibly proud of the organization and the progress and success that it has had. And while I was the primary torchbearer for its early years, the organization is made up of so many thousands of volunteers and people who so generously donate and our incredible staff. It is an idea, it is a mission, and it is a movement that I am really just honored to be a part of. But the catalyst story for Mercy for Animals is I became a vegetarian when I was 11. I went to an Earth Day event at a local mall and picked up a brochure on factory farming and read for the first time about mother pigs being locked in gestation crates and cows being chained by their necks in veal crates and hens being locked in battery cages. And I decided at that moment that I didn't want to pay someone to mistreat animals in a way that I found objectionable. So I went vegetarian. I started getting involved in activism. I went to my first animal rights conference when I was 13. But really, the turning point for me in terms of this becoming an issue that I cared about to an issue that I would dedicate my life to was in 1999. There was an animal abuse case at our local high school. And again, being in a rural community, this is a heavily agriculture area. So the local high school had a Future Farmers of America class, and the teacher of that class, his name was Steve Jenkins, was also a pig farmer. He raised over 10,000 pigs. It was a very large operation. He decided that there would be a dissection project in the class, and instead of using computer models or any other sort of alternative, he decided that he would kill baby piglets on his farm. And bring them to the school for this project. So one morning, he arrived with a bucket of baby piglets that he had tried to kill that morning. Now, when he arrived to the classroom, one of the students, who also did part-time work on Mr. Jenkins' farm, noticed that one of the piglets was still alive. She was standing on top of the other piglets in this bucket. The student walked over, grabbed the piglet by her hind legs, and slammed her headfirst into the ground in an attempt to kill her. Now, this piglet, who was so brave and had such a spark for life, didn't die after the second assault that morning. A few of the students were just shocked and horrified by what was happening in front of them. They grabbed this piglet, they left the classroom, they went down the hallway to the classroom of another student named Molly, who was a first year teacher at the school. She was known as the vegetarian who cared about animals. Molly left the school with this dying piglet cradled in her arms, and she drove to the local veterinarian office to have the piglet euthanized. There's nothing that they could do to save this animal at this point. Molly's next stop was to the sheriff's department, where she filed a cruelty to animals complaint. Now, this became a huge deal in this local community. It was in the paper, it was on the local TV news, and it went to court, it went to trial. And the very first day, the charges were dismissed because slamming piglets headfirst into the ground is considered standard agricultural practice. It's so common in the pork industry. It's considered a cheap and oftentimes effective way of killing piglets that it is given the term thumping. And Ohio law, like almost every other law in the U.S., exempts standard agricultural practices from being labeled cruel and being prosecuted as such. So this case, which happened just a few miles from my home, illustrated to me, again, at the age of 15, that there needed to be an organization that would speak up on behalf of these animals. And Mercy for Animals was born out of that. It was clear to me that had this been a puppy that someone brought to the school and a student had slammed that puppy headfirst into the ground, that the outcome would have been very different. There would have been a cruelty prosecution, and the perpetrator likely would have been referred for psychiatric evaluation and prohibited from having contact with animals. But because it was a pig, it was considered good business.
Crazy. Nathan, we have to take a short break. Nathan and I will be right back. Stay with us. Hi, Maria here, and I have a message due to the pressure of the times we're living in. I'm calling on all students and millennials to get the education they need to fight the fascism taking over our world. I've made a special subscription offer for students and for seniors on a limited budget. For just $9.99 a month, you can subscribe and get that education. Over 500 hours of real education that's necessary to understand the world, the problems, and the solutions. Remember, knowledge is power. Together, you can change the world, but to do so, you must be informed of what's really going on and have real facts to support you in your endeavors. It's time for all the grandmothers to take a stand and teach the younger generation what their life could be and how to get there. Help me help you. One person cannot do it alone, and the guidance you seek is right here at www.maria.net, M-E-R-I-A.net. Your generation is the generation we've been waiting for, so let me help you. Thanks for listening. Okay, welcome back to the show. I hope you're enjoying it. I know I am. Nathan Runkel, still one of my favorite heroes. I'm sure you don't think of yourself as a hero, but I do, Nathan, of Mercy for Animals. Before we continue our discussion, how can people help? Should they just go over to mercyforanimals.org, make a donation? If there's, what's the best way?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of things that people can do to help. And certainly supporting Mercy for Animals is one of those ways. And yes, you can go over to mercyforanimals.org. You can find us on all of the social media platforms at Mercy for Animals. You can make a donation. We are funded entirely by donations from kind-hearted people who want to make this world a kinder place. For all creatures, including those who are used for food. So that's something that we appreciate very much. I think the other thing that people can do is really look at their own choices, their own food choices, and ask themselves, are these a reflection of who I am? Do these embody my values? And I know for me, kindness and compassion and justice are really fundamental values for me. And when I looked at what was happening for the meat, dairy, and egg industry, I knew in good conscience I couldn't support that. So I think that moving towards a plant-based diet is one of the best personal choices that we can make. It's said that simply by leaving meat off of your plate, by pushing it off and eating all the incredible plant-based foods that are available, you can spare dozens of animals every single year, which can add up to thousands over a lifetime. So diet changes is really important.
Well, you know, it's interesting because when my friend told me about having to move on to insulin and the fact that his doctor didn't give him a diet, which I found hard to believe, I did some research and I went over to the Mayo Clinic. And the Mayo Clinic's recommendation for diabetes is a diet of fruits, vegetables, and whole grains and unsweetened drinks. And they actually said in the article three times, Nathan, this is the best diet for everyone.
Sure.
So, you know, of course, I forwarded that information. I don't know if it'll fall on deaf ears or not. But I know if it was me, I'd want to know all I had to know, not to have to suffer like that. So anyway, talking about suffering, you've taken on some of the biggest food producers in the country. Everybody from Tyson, Burger King, I believe Walmart, Costco, even the circus. And that couldn't have been easy, but it was effective.
Yeah, and before I mention that, I also just want to direct people to thegreenplate.com, which is a website that we have that provides meal plans, tips, recipes. People can get a free vegetarian starter guide. It's a one-stop shop for everything that you need to know, from health to cooking to move towards a plant-based diet. So thegreenplate.com.
Oh, that's great.
So in terms of our work to get companies to make changes, I think it's been some of the most impactful work that we've ever done. If you stop to think about the power that corporations have over animals, it's really quite remarkable. In the United States, about a quarter, 25% of all the groceries purchased are from Walmart. One company is where a quarter of all of groceries are purchased. If you look at McDonald's, they use about 2% of all of the eggs in the entire country. So these corporations have incredible power in terms of how animals live and die. And in many cases, they have more power than individual states do in dictating what happens on these industrial factory farms. So it's been really important for us to hold these companies accountable and to engage with them, whether it's through dialogue or through protest or through investigations, to hold them to a standard that at the bare minimum, these animals shouldn't be tortured. They should have basic freedom of movement. They shouldn't be kept in cages where they can't move. They shouldn't be subjected to mutilations without pain relief. They shouldn't have their throats slit while conscious in the slaughterhouses. So I tell a number of stories in the book about these campaigns. One is about an investigation that one of our incredible undercover agents carried out in Wisconsin at a massive dairy factory farm. And he worked there for a few weeks and documented these pregnant cows that were kept in overcrowded conditions. You know, most cows raised for dairy have no access to open pasture. They're raised on manure-coated concrete flooring, crowded together, moved to electric milking machines multiple times a day. Their babies are born, they're taken away from them, never to be seen again. On top of all of that, our investigator also documented malicious abuse, sadistic abuse to the cows there from workers who become desensitized to these animals. They view them as a hurdle and an obstacle to getting their job done. And that leads to animals being beaten, being shocked with electric prods. And on many dairy farms, these cows become so overworked, so taxed, so exhausted that they become what are called by the industry downers, which means that they're unable to even stand up. And these animals are incredibly vulnerable to abuse. So we documented workers taking chains, wrapping them around these cows' necks, and then using tractors to pull them down the alleyways, hoisting these cows off of the ground by their hips, just really terrible abuse. Mm-hmm. We were able to connect this large dairy farm to DiGiorno Pizza, the dairy being turned into cheese that was used on DiGiorno Pizza, which is one of the largest and most well-known frozen pizza brands. Mm-hmm. But DiGiorno is owned by Nestle, which is the world's largest food company. Now, we targeted Nestle with this investigation. We rebranded it DiGiorno Disgusting and released this investigation to the media, and people around the globe were horrified by what they saw. And it was because of this investigation and the abuse that we documented that animal cruelty charges were not only filed, but were pushed through the courts, and multiple workers are found guilty. But more importantly, it brought Nestle to the table to have a long overdue discussion about animal cruelty in their food supply. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of negotiation and discussion, but ultimately Nestle really stepped up to the plate, and they adopted at the time the most comprehensive farmed animal welfare policy perhaps of any food company. And it not only addressed some of the worst abuses faced by cows used in dairy production, but also prevented the confinement of mother pigs in veal crates, calves in veal crates, hens in battery cages, the genetic manipulation of broiler chickens, the live shackle and slaughter of animals for meat, and a host of other issues. And what was also really heartening about this is that this policy didn't just apply to the United States. It applied to all countries where Nestle operated, which is over 90 countries. It affected hundreds of thousands of farms and suppliers. So it was a ripple through the food industry. And since then, we have been able to get large food companies from McDonald's to Walmart to adopt similar policies. Now, the truth is that this is progress, but it is far from perfection.
Right.
And these policies are only as good as their implementation. And getting animals out of tiny cages and ending mutilations of them does not mean that these animals live happy, joyful lives. But we believe that as long as animals are being raised and killed for food, which unfortunately is not going to end tomorrow, we should do everything in our power to provide as much relief to these animals, to prevent the worst suffering. Mm-hmm. So we view this as a step forward. This is not a step over the finish line. This is not the end goal or result, but this is meaningful for literally millions of animals every year.
Absolutely. Now, you talk about in your book, and I've seen posts of it, and for whatever reason, people are repulsed by the entire idea of clean meat, meat that's generated in a lab. What's your view on that?
I'm incredibly supportive of it. So supportive, in fact, that I helped co-found an organization called the Good Food Institute, which supports innovation in the food space with a goal of helping to foster and promote and accelerate alternatives to meat, dairy, and egg products. Creating products that are cheaper, safer, better for the environment, and cruelty-free. I think if we look at many of the dramatic changes throughout our society, we see that they were actually driven by competitive economic factors. For example, about 100 years ago, our streets were crowded with horses pulling overweight carriages. These are animals that were oftentimes abused. They were subject to overwork and the blistering heat and the searing cold. But something changed in the early 1900s that really led to the eradication of horses being used in that way. And that was, of course, the invention of the Model T. Henry Ford, who was not an animal advocate, actually had the effect of helping more horses, perhaps, than most animal advocates at that time. Now, of course, the Model T had its own challenges, but today I drive an electric car that can be powered by solar energy. So it has started the evolution of transportation. And I think that clean meat is doing the same thing for the food space and specifically the protein space. And just just so people know what clean meat is. Mm-hmm. It's real meat made out of animal cells. And it is done by taking a small pea-sized harmless biopsy from any animal, in this case, let's say a cow, and taking stem cells, growing it in a suitable medium, and essentially a bioreactor, a sort of brewery, if you will, and growing real muscle tissue. And so the end result is a real hamburger patty made out of real flesh, but it is meat without the murder. Right. It is cruelty-free. And these cells can be so self-replicating that, in theory, you could produce tons, literally tons, of meat from just a few parent cells. So this has the potential to eradicate factory farming as we know it in our time.
It kind of makes me want...
Incredibly exciting.
Well, it kind of makes me wonder, though, you know, where's big agriculture, these industrial farms, you know, on that? Mm-hmm. I would think they would probably lobby to their last breath against something like this because it would cut into their profit.
Well, it's really interesting because the meat industry oftentimes views itself as the protein industry and the protein sector. Mm-hmm. And in that way, you know, Tyson and Smithfield are not run by sadistic individuals who get a cheap thrill off of torturing animals. To them, it is a means to an end to produce meat or protein and then turn a profit. So if there is a way to do that, to produce protein, to produce meat in a better way that could be cheaper, cleaner, more efficient, and cause less harm to people, animals, and the environment, that's just good business. And what we are seeing now is investments coming in to some of the clean meat companies, such as Memphis Meats, from the largest meat companies. Just this past week, Tyson did a $17 million investment in Memphis Meats, a clean meat company. Mm. Before that, Cargill, one of the largest meat companies, also did an investment in clean meat. So we are seeing more and more of the largest meat companies not fight clean meat, but say, this could revolutionize our business, and they're getting on board with it, just as we're starting to see many of the energy companies getting on board more and more with solar. You can either choose to resist change, or you can choose to embrace it.
Right.
And the reason that this is called clean meat, just like it's called clean energy, is because it is better for the environment. Studies show that it produces 50% less greenhouse gas emissions than raising and killing animals for food. It uses more than 90% less water, 90% less energy, 90% less land. And again, that's good business and it's good for the environment. But it's also called clean meat because it literally is cleaner. When you see what happens on factory farms, it's very clear that these animals are living in filth. When you cram tens of thousands of animals into windowless sheds, they're covered in feces. And those same animals go to the slaughterhouse. Mm. They're dunked in scalding tanks of water to remove their feathers or loosen their hair through the slaughter process. And these are really fecal soup. And we see high levels of contamination of microbials that are incredibly dangerous and harmful for people, such as Salmonella, E. coli, Campylobacter. Mm-hmm. When we create clean meat in a sterile environment, all of that goes away. So it literally is cleaner. There's not the same risk of bacterial contamination that really goes hand in hand with traditional animal
water. All right. Well, hey, just the fact that it saves so much water on a planet that's running out of water is great. Mm-hmm. But let me ask you this, just to my own self, what's the difference then with clean meat or eating all these vegan meats? Does it cost more money to make all these vegan products than the clean meat?
Well, as of now, clean meat is expensive. But, you know, the first iPhone cost a few billion dollars to invent, but now the cost has gone down quite a lot. So So a lot of this is a matter of scalability and the growth medium formula. Mm-hmm. I do believe that as clean meat becomes more widely available and is produced on a larger scale, it has the potential to be cheaper than traditional animal products. And of course, we also have to ask ourselves, what is the true cost of traditional animal products? What is the cost to our environment? Mm-hmm. But also, there are so many government subsidies that go into keeping animal products artificially low that we, as a nation, are paying that, literally, financially paying that through other sources of taxes.
Right.
But, you know, clean meat isn't really designed for vegans. And I think anyone that wants to maintain a plant-based diet absolutely should. I think that for the other 90%+ Americans who are not vegan but want their meat, this is really for them. And
absolutely.
I think that it can have a transformative effect.
Well, I think it will for sure. But for me, I could tell you right now, clean or dirty, I'm not going back. Nathan, I want to thank you so much for joining me again, and I look forward to doing this again with you, hopefully not, you know, in 5 years from now, hopefully sooner. So thank you so much.
Absolutely. It's always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Same here. You take good care, Nathan. Bye. Nathan Runkle, and he'll always be one of my favorite heroes. That kid is something else. So again, it's all choice. Listen, we only have two votes that count, people. We could vote with our fork and we vote with our dollars. So vote with your conscience. Anyway, thanks for listening to the show. Get over to mercyforanimals.org. Check out thegreenplate.com because I have a lot of people saying, where do I start? Obviously, he's got the place for you to start. Thanks for listening and supporting the show. I'll see you guys tomorrow.
Thank you for listening and supporting The Maria Show. Tell others what you learned today. Knowledge becomes wisdom only when it's shared. Encourage others to subscribe today. www.maria.net. Often imitated, never duplicated. A world of information all in one place. www.maria.net. Always ahead of the curve. Always on your side. Get active or get radioactive. Subscribe today.